If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share, leave us a message on our hotline number at 513-900-2955.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two never-nominated Oscar people who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
And today our guest is Anne Speckhard, director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, also known as the ICSV, and adjunct associate professor of psychiatry in the School of Medicine at Georgetown University. So she's going to tell us about her experiences speaking to hundreds of extremists, terrorists, and former terrorists from groups like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the KKK, Proud Boys, many more, and how she's gotten so many of these people to open up to her and the factors that drive people to extremism.
We'll also discuss whether terrorists are quote-unquote evil, what to do if someone you know seems to be spiraling into extremism, and the de-radicalization work she does with ICSVE.
They do really cool stuff, y'all. I'm like really stoked on this episode, honestly.
Oh, this is your dream job.
It is my dream. It literally... You're so right, it is. I want to talk to extremists and bring them back to earth.
I can see this for you, Lola.
If only I had my degrees, which I'll complain about every week until I die, instead of actually getting one. No, I want to make movies. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's the prob.
Speaking of which, this is not my cultiest thing, but I am going to shamelessly self-promote for the next 4 weeks, y'all, because I'm launching a crowdfunding campaign.
Oh, hello.
Unrelated to this podcast, for a short film that I'm doing. It's a political horror short film.
Oh.
Some elevated horror, baby. About a right-wing commentator whose name gets cited in a mass shooting and how she has to contend with her conscience in a very gruesome sort of way. So if y'all want to donate, that would be amazing. You can go to bit.ly/pruningfilm. Pruning as in, like, you know, pruning the plant. I just had to do it. I'm going to do it next 4 weeks. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. It's very embarrassing.
No. I hope you get it made. It sounds really great.
Thank you. Thank you. We have some really cool people interested, so fingers crossed. Maybe I can finally join the cult of Sundance.
Woohoo. Yes.
But before we get into our interview, I have to know, what's the cultiest thing that's happened to you this week?
Okay. This is fun. This is ironic. This has layers. I went to a concert this weekend, Lola.
Mm-hmm.
And people were calling my boyfriend and I cult leaders in like a lovely way. Yes. Like they were like, oh, you guys are the cult leaders, and like joking about how our house is a cult. And then we had a party, like a little thing. And like a lot of people wore white to be funny. So it's very ironic.
Oh, they wore what? Wait, you had a thing, like a party at your house?
Yeah. Yeah. Like a potluck, and everybody wore white.
Dude, I totally see that for you guys.
Yeah.
It's like such a communal house.
Yeah. It felt real. It was like, oh, wait, I do have a little cult, don't I?
But like a sweet cult.
Yeah, it's a sweet cult. There's nothing bad yet. Until I decide I want to like rescue every cat in California and start, I don't know, doing something crazy.
Cat cult.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I think I knew a guy who had a, wow. I knew someone who had something named cat cult, but now I can't remember what it was. I think he was a photographer. Yeah. I was going to say, you have a cat cult, but I'm like, yeah,
I want one.
Have used that phrase before. I'll join your cat cult. Well, no, honestly, I would be a dog cult. I will have a rival cult.
Yeah, but you really like my cat.
I do really. If it was your cat, like just carbon copies of your cat, I would do it. I like cats who act like dogs.
She's sitting right here waiting for me to turn back on the heater.
Little chicken nugget. You guys, it's so cute.
She's so cute. You guys follow her on Instagram. She hasn't posted in 4 years because my old roommate no longer lives with me, but I'm Fen. What about you, Lola? Come look at her body. What about you? What's the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
Well, so I got a DM from someone asking about whether we are going to address Evan Rachel Wood's new documentary, or I guess the new documentary about her and her abuse from
Phoenix Rising.
Yes, Phoenix Rising from Marilyn Manson. And I actually didn't know about it until I got that DM. So thank you for the DM. However, I haven't watched it yet because I don't know if I have the emotional capacity to watch it yet.
Yeah.
I have like such complicated feelings about that stuff because it's like, I feel shame about having dated him. And I know that that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, well, I wasn't abused and I dated him. And I like had an article that like came out with a song about him that like capitalized on that. And I didn't know, obviously, that this stuff had been going on.
Right.
But I still feel fucking weird about it. And I feel like it's going to be really hard for me to watch because I'm like, we never got to the point where he was abusive to me, but he absolutely love bombed me. And even in the like several weeks that we were talking, like even literally before we had met, he was just texting me from tour, like pretty all consuming of my life, like pretty like,
of course,
wanting you to like give everything up and not talk to anyone else and just texting like nonstop all fucking day. All of those things that narcissistic abusers do, Armie Hammer seems to have done the same thing to all of those women. And I guess it's going to just be hard to see what somebody that I dated, however briefly, he still fucking basically said he loved me and introduced me to his dad.
Yeah.
Basically tortured Evan Rachel Wood. Like, that's just hard. That's just going to be hard to watch.
Yeah. I had lunch with a friend today who said it was the worst thing she's ever seen. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I know I like have to be prepared. I'm like, will I even watch it? I don't know. Like, I obviously know that it happened and believe that she's a victim, as are all of those other women. Like,
well,
I don't know. Yeah.
Here's a question that my friend had. She was like, why isn't this everywhere? Bad vegans everywhere, which we really need to discuss because I don't think we have yet. But why is nobody talking about this movie? And her thought was she feels like it's kind of being buried and hidden. And
it is interesting that I was shocked that it had come out and I had not heard of it.
Same.
Outside of somebody literally like DMing it to me to be like, talk about this.
Yeah.
It is weird. It's weird. I don't know. I don't feel like people, like obviously his fan base want to defend him, but I think for the most part, everybody knows he's a piece of shit, you know?
Yeah. 1+1=2 with that one.
Yeah. I mean, at least everyone in my social media circles, they're like, fuck Marilyn Manson. So I don't know exactly. Maybe it's just that there are so many popular docs right now that are like more fun. Like, I don't know. Because the ones you're talking about, like all of those scam artist ones, they're like crimey, but it's not like too heavy. It's more like fun.
It's kind of fluffy.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, not for Sarma.
Not for the victims, but like it's more true crime than it is like, I mean, I haven't watched even that one. I just mean generally.
Wow, you really need to watch that today. It is so good.
Dude, I know I have so much to catch up on. My watching has been bad because I've been so focused on this campaign for this film.
That's really bad, Lola. You need to be focusing on Bad Vegan.
I know. I heard it's amazing. I heard it's amazing. Anyway, I'm going to watch it at some point and we can talk about it more at length. I mean, if Evan Rachel Wood would come on, that would be fucking incredible. I would love to hear her story directly. But I'm like, it makes me feel like upset in my body just like reading about the things that he did to her.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's not even like that could have happened to me. But that, yes, logically very much could have happened to me.
Ugh.
But because it didn't, I feel guilt or something? I don't know.
Well, it makes sense just in the way our brains process stuff. You know, it seems to be a common conclusion people come to, which is feeling guilt.
Yeah, we'll dive in soon, but just wanted to mention it. Okay, well, get ready, y'all. This is a super, super interesting person and interview, and you're going to learn so much. So let's talk to Anne now. Welcome, Anne Speckhard. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am like so excited to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
So you are the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry in the School of Medicine at Georgetown University. You've consulted with NATO, foreign governments, and the U.S. Department of State, Defense, Justice, Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, CIA, FBI, basically everyone, and you've interviewed hundreds of terrorists. Did I miss anything?
No, you got it right. And it's about 800 now.
800. Incredible. So first of all, what initially led you to become interested in this field?
Well, I'm married to a U.S. ambassador, and he dragged me from my private practice overseas, and I kept having to reinvent myself with each move. So I fell into interviewing terrorists.
As one does.
Exactly.
What were you doing before? What was your practice focused on before?
I was a trauma psychologist, garden variety private practice, but I had a specialty in trauma. Dissociative disorders, that's when someone's confused about their identity, or they lose time, or they kind of hover outside their body and see themselves from outside, or don't feel that anything around them is real.
That would be me.
Yeah.
Good 20% of the time.
Trauma must come into what you do now a lot.
It definitely does. And it was really interesting to me about, 20 years ago when we started presenting our data from Chechnya and the terrorists that joined there, because I'm always looking at a life history with a person and what is their trajectory into terrorism? What were the motivations? How did they get in? How did online element? What did that have to do with it? And then what their experiences are in the group and their disillusionment, disengagement, and de-radicalization if they are de-radicalized. Mm. I remember going to a NATO group 20 or 25 years ago and saying that most of the people that had joined the Chechen terrorists had really bad PTSD and being left out of the room that I was some kind of liberal. Trauma can be a driver for joining a terrorist or a violent extremist group. But I was the first one to introduce that, you know, to the other practitioners who were mostly political scientists and were looking at it through a political science lens.
Isn't that interesting how, like, I feel like trauma is so well known now as a thing that happens and it's so much in the zeitgeist, but it really wasn't that long ago that people weren't taking trauma very seriously, generally outside of like literal war and being in the battlefield and the shell shock, I guess.
Even being in the battlefield, when I graduated, I got my PhD in 85. And I remember a lot of things that weren't covered in our training. One was incest. I gave a presentation to my graduate school group on it and said, look, this book is saying that incest isn't harmful to girls and rape isn't harmful to women. You know, it's just crazy. PTSD was just being defined. Charles Figley was a big figure at that time. And the International Society for the Study of Traumatic Stress was started. I joined it. Mm. But I remember the topic that I studied for my PhD was women that had high stress reactions to abortion. They had had PTSD reactions.
Wow.
And that doesn't mean every woman will have that. These particular women did. And a combat vet contacted me and said, you realize what you're writing about is PTSD. But I didn't realize. And I was just out of a very reputable PhD program.
Wow, fascinating. And what an interesting perspective to come into this other work with.
We were posted in Belarus for my husband's first ambassadorship. Then we went to Belgium. I lived in Belgium for 7 years. He went to Iraq for 2 of those years. And then we went to Greece for 3 years. So we were out for a total of 13 years. Mm. And that's the time when I started interviewing terrorists. I had a student that in Belgium came to class and said, I think I have this PTSD thing. And I was like, well, it's PTSD. I'm sure you want to talk about it in front of the whole class. And he said he did. And he had been in an explosion in Hebrew University. And he had just walked out from the cafeteria when it exploded from a backpack bomb and everyone inside was killed. Mm. And he pushed me really hard to study the Palestinians. I was already studying the Chechens. And it went from there.
Wow. So first of all, when we talk about terrorism, I think most people generally would think of ISIS. And I'm curious, what is the definition that you use? Does it match what the U.S. government uses? And have you worked with any terrorists in the U.S.?
The U.S. government has about 5 different main definitions. So the FBI is different than the State Department and so on. But basically what I use is that it's a non-state actor with a political intent to influence politics that uses violence against property or persons and aimed at civilian targets.
Okay.
It gets blurry sometimes when you look at groups like Hamas or the Chechen jihadists that were aiming a lot of times for military checkpoints. In some definitions of terrorism, you don't count those as terrorist acts.
Right.
But if it's a group that's also targeting pizzerias and airports and metro, then I would put it all together as terrorism.
Gotcha. We can get more into what's going on in the U.S. and what you consider terrorism here. But have you engaged with many people who meet that definition here?
Well, here we started in the November before the January 6th attacks. We were getting concerned about the domestic terrorism problem. And we started interviewing white supremacists from many different groups. So I've now completed 50 interviews. They're all about 2 hours long. And some of these people have engaged in stabbings, in firebombing synagogues. One of them got caught, thankfully, by the FBI in a sting operation, but he purchased a rifle that he was planning to take into a synagogue and shoot everyone. You know, this is definitely domestic terrorism.
Right. Can you just name some of the groups that you've interviewed people from, just generally?
Well, when it comes to militant jihadist. It's mainly ISIS, 273 of ISIS. I have also interviewed with Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Palestinian groups, Hamas, PFLP. I talked to some Hezbollah in Lebanon. And then with the white supremacists, it can go from KKK, National Socialist Movement, Proud Boys, Aryan Brotherhood, Aryan Nations.
Wow.
I don't remember them all.
Wow. Wow. Everyone, basically. These are such dangerous people and situations. And obviously, you're talking to a lot of people who are maybe de-radicalized or on the path of being de-radicalized. But how do you get people like that to trust you? And what is that like?
Well, with ISIS, I talked to people that returned to their home countries and were not jailed. And I talked to people that crossed into Turkey and were not imprisoned. And that's a little scary because you never know exactly what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've gone into the Syrian prisons. Syrian Democratic Forces has been very supportive of our project, which we call Breaking the ISIS Brand. Because all of our interviews, we ask permission to video and then to take the top content out of their video and create a counter narrative video, which is an insider speaking against the group. Same thing in Sulaymaniyah, Iraq, and Baghdad. I got into the prisons. And prisons, it's a little different because there's a guard sitting with you most of the time.
Right.
But what I found is that all of these people appreciate some compassion, and I'm a compassionate interviewer. They seem to appreciate that they get a chance to look at their life as a whole with a psychologist. The guys in prison are lonely and are just happy to be out of their cell, especially talking to a woman.
Right.
But they're also really curious when they find out how many people I've talked to. They're curious. So that's an advantage for me. They don't want to talk to journalists. Many of them. I mean, some of them do. Some of them are big press rats. You know, they're concerned about how it's going to be presented and if the person's thoughtful or just looking for some sensational headline. And then with the white supremacist, I haven't gone into prisons at all. I've talked to people that some of them have been in prison. Some of them have been in our military.
Oh,
and
scary.
Some of them are de-radicalized and some of them are still quite radicalized. But I would say the whole sample of 50, they were at least starting the process of disengagement, de-radicalization.
Oh, wow. Gosh, I guess let's just start with, I think, the biggest question of the day, which is, in your experience, hundreds of interviews, all different kinds of groups, what are some of the recurring factors that you see that draw people into extremism, terrorism?
I came up with this theory called the lethal cocktail of terrorism. And I would say there's almost always a group involved. So we have the Unabomber. He made his own ideology and he acted independently, but he's also a college mathematics professor. And we had Christopher Dorner. He was an LAPD police officer that had been trained as a sniper, and he became a sniper all on his own, wrote his own ideology.
Right.
But most often people resonate to a group. And they pick up the group's ideology. They don't write their own. And even if they act as a lone wolf, they pick up the group's ideology. You know, they may personalize it in some way. So there's four things. There's the group, the ideology, then there's social support. And we used to find back in the days of Al-Qaeda that people had to travel to Pakistan to get their social support. They had to work their way into a group and really be trusted because the group was taking a risk to take them in. But now with the way social media is and the internet, right now, I don't know where you're sitting. You know, it feels like we're in the same room together. That's how it is now. So very quickly, you can assemble social support around a person who you want to recruit. You know, you can Twitter blast him, love bomb him, make him feel really included and really supported to take part in terrorism. And the more social support there is, the more willing a person will be to join. So those are the first three things, the group, the ideology, social support. And then the fourth is what's inside of you, your motivations and your vulnerabilities. So with white supremacists, we found belonging was a really important motivation and vulnerability, wanting some kind of noble purpose and a feeling of significance. And a lot of these people in our sample had been born in pretty rough homes. Their parents maybe never even married. And there was violence and drugs in their home. Chaos. So as young people, they were really looking for something to belong to and then got they either self-exposed or the group found them. And then they were exposed to these ideologies and to the group itself. And we find what pulls people in is a sense of belonging and, oh, I'm an elite and I don't have to think what's the cause of my failures in life. It's somebody else's.
Right.
It's not that I failed. It's that the Jews are running everything.
Mm.
This becomes very powerful. So that's the first step in. And then the group starts directing their hate in the sense of saying, okay, you're in this elite group, but now you have a purpose. And your purpose is to understand our ideology, adhere to it, and carry out acts on behalf of it. So you have to hate minorities. You have to stay away from minorities. You have to hate Jews, even if you've never met one. And you have to spread this. And when the group engages in violence, support it. And possibly even be one of the people that does engage in violence. So we call that process directed hate.
How often would you say, just in your experience, approximately, would a person who joins a group like that have some kind of either traumatic or tumultuous, like living in a conflict zone or just, you know, a traumatic childhood, basically a troubled background? Like, how frequent is that?
Well, in the motivation section, I came up with 50 variables. Mm-hmm. And on our website, the ICSVE website, we have this paper, The Lethal Cocktail of Terrorism, and all 50 variables are laid out. But it can be as simple as you're in love with somebody and they say, come with me to ISIS, to Syria, or you fall in love with somebody that's in the Klan and you start going with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all trauma driven. It's sometimes wanting to feel that you're really helping other people. A lot of people got drawn into ISIS because they believed that they could practice their religion in a more true way and they wouldn't be harassed anymore or discriminated against as they were in their home areas. I mean, the list goes on. It's really 50. It's belonging, significance, purpose, sense of adventure, money.
Mm.
You know, some of these white supremacist gangs are stealing things, drugs, women. If you joined ISIS, you were promised a sex slave.
Right.
And you were promised that you would get married.
Right.
So you could be a complete loser or unable to get married where you lived. And if you went to Syria, they promised you a wife.
Right. So basically, if you have a need, they can probably fill it, is what they're promising.
That's exactly right. That's a good point. And I always say that no one joins a terrorist organization without having the belief that they're going to meet your needs, because that's the first thing the recruiter does. He figures out what are your needs and starts convincing you that they're going to meet your needs and gives you such a good sense about yourself, about your belonging, about your purpose, that as time goes on, you begin to fuse your identity with the group. And then the group has no real interest in meeting your needs. The group has the interest of the group and they're going to use you. But when you're fused to the group and to their ideology, you probably have become a true believer.
Right. Yeah. The reason I asked about the trauma thing was because I think that's like the most intuitive one. Like, we understand, like, if I'm living in a conflict zone, like, and I believe that it's a particular group that's the cause of it, it makes sense that I would join a group that would fight that group. Or if I had a, you know, really traumatic childhood, you know, just overcoming the demons in my head would probably lead me down a path like that, or like could have the potential to lead me down a path like that. But I do find it so interesting that there are so many people who don't necessarily have those things in their backgrounds and are just either targeted or stumble upon it. Like, is it typically that they're targeted, or can it just kind of happen organically?
It happens both ways, and now it's online. But if you're hurting, you're seeking out people that might meet your needs. So you might go seeking the group. And if you're in a conflict zone, you're right, it's a no-brainer. It's a lot about trauma. It's a lot about revenge. It's a lot about they took my territory. They raped my sister. They tortured my brother.
Right.
It's very trauma-driven. But still, you see people in conflict zones figuring out who the groups are that would be willing to equip them for revenge and them joining instead of, you know, active recruitment. But we see the same thing in non-conflict zones, that people are searching on the internet and they find something that appeals to them for some reason, or they start chatting with someone and the person tells them, well, you know, it's not you, it's the Jews. And, you know, you're white, you should be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just sucks them in. So in some ways, there has to be some resonance to the ideology for it to catch you, but it doesn't have to be a lot. But the more resonance that's already there, the better, of course. I think when you talk about trauma, it's sure easier to manipulate someone, like you alluded to having dissociative states earlier in the podcast. I don't know if you were kidding around or if that was for real.
No, that was for real.
Okay. Well, if you lived that way, you know, when you're spotty about your consciousness, that at the times when you're kind of gone, there might be somebody else present or nobody present, but that's a time when you're really vulnerable to being manipulated. And recruiters figure that out too. And they can push you in ways that if you were fully present, maybe you would catch on to, and they can trick you.
So these people are so smart that they're looking for people going through shit almost.
Well, you know, think about it. A stage hypnotist, you know, they look out on their crowd and they figure out who's, you know, going deep into trance and who's easily played with. And those are the people they call up to stage. And I think it's probably intuitive. I don't know if those stage hypnotists go through any training. And fortune tellers do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, they notice when you're getting kind of fuzzy. And then, you know, they can draw information out of you and feed it back to you. So you think that they can see your life and know everything about you.
Right.
And recruiters stumble upon these things intuitively, and then they use it, of course. And any group that's using your religion has one over on you already, because if they know these are sacred, sacred scriptures and probably sacred values to you, all they have to show you is how those sacred scriptures or values are being offended by others to make you upset.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they may kick you into a dissociative mode by upsetting you. And then you're more vulnerable. But either way, they can play with the verses and twist them. So I worked with an abortion clinic terrorist. She didn't do really too much damage to the clinics that she tried to burn down when they were being constructed. But she was facing 25 years mandatory sentencing. And she had been very manipulated by, I believe it was a government informant, government paid informant, that she said, assembled the whole group and said, you know, nobody did anything during the Holocaust. And people knew that there was a crematorium in their community, but they didn't go and destroy it. They didn't stand up to the Germans. And now we all condemn them. So they used this, you know, societal story that all of us, if we're against the Nazis, adhere to, but brought it into a different situation.
Right.
And then he also quoted scriptures about, ultimately, she found in her mailbox a manual called the Army of God manual. And it was about unborn babies calling out to people like her to be warriors for them. And supposedly written from a Christian perspective.
Right. Yeah. So they can really prey on any pre-existing belief, basically, as well as like need for, you know, social support, need for meaning and purpose, a need for financial support, and like basically any need can be preyed upon.
Right. And we found plenty of these guys contacting young women and flirting with them and making it sound like it was a big adventure and you don't have to get married to your Pakistani cousin. Come here.
Right.
And you're doing God's work.
Right.
And God gives you permission to rebel in this way.
How often is it women? My perception is it's like vast, vast, vast majority men, but it seems like you have interviewed a number of women.
Yeah. Terrorism and violent extremism is mainly a man's game, but there's women in these groups too. They're usually not in leadership roles. In the leftist groups, we saw some women in leadership roles way back when, but not as much now. But it's both men and women that get tricked.
Right.
And there are plenty of ISIS men that told me that they felt tricked. And there were plenty of white supremacist men who felt that they'd been brainwashed. So, for instance, you know, take this Christian identity, if you can call it a theology, being taught from the KKK and groups like that, that takes Christianity but goes back to the story of the serpent and says, well, you know, Jews and minorities were created ahead of time. Then God created Adam and Eve and said, you have dominion over all this creation, all these animals.
Hmm.
And so Black people and minorities are just the animals you have dominion over. Or the serpent was just a symbol, but he was really Satan in the flesh. And Satan had sex with Eve. That's how he tricked her. And her bad seed, Cain, is the progenitor of all the evil people in the world, all the Jews.
Right, right.
And just think, you know, if you believe in the Adam and Eve story and then somebody with any credibility starts explaining this all to you and opens the Bible and says, look, Jesus said, because Jesus did say, according to the Bible, you sons of the devil to the Jews. But he was talking to specific people at a specific time about a specific hypocrisy that they were following. He wasn't saying all Jews are the spawn of Satan. But, you know, they connected.
Right, right. It's a very common thing when we think of a terrorist, we think of almost like a caricature. Maybe this is my perception of how Americans perceive terrorism, and I'm sure that obviously this is not true of everyone. But, you know, it's someone who's like committing evil acts. And we want to believe that the only people who can commit evil acts are people who are evil. And I'm wondering your perspective as a psychologist, do you find that people typically are psychologically pretty normal? Are there any, you know, recurring factors of mental illness or anything? Or is it just kind of anyone?
I think the whole concept of evil, when you really start diving into it, falls apart.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we tend to call people that harm us or harm our loved ones or our property evil. But are they? You know, and when we start digging into all the psychosocial things that are going on, then you a little bit lose track of that label of evil that you put on a person.
Yeah.
We know that most serial killers had really horrible childhoods, and some of them are dissociative themselves, you know, killing when they're in a dissociative state. I wouldn't say that makes them innocent, and I would never excuse their behaviors, but I don't know. I mean, The concept of evil, if you really, really start looking into it, it doesn't hold up well.
Right.
And I think it's better to look at what are all the factors that are driving your behavior and how much are you responsible for them? I mean, we have this concept in Christianity, at least, of free will. But I always ask myself, is a crack baby that's born addicted, do they have free will?
Right.
Most of us do. And a lot of us hand over our free will to addictions, to other people. But that's a choice that you made, you know, so you have responsibility at those junctures in your life. But there are some people that I don't think they ever have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. It's basically the premise of this show. But yeah, we are interested in the why of extreme behavior of all kinds. And generally, I agree that evil is sort of an irrelevant word. A criminal act is one thing, but what does evil actually mean? Like,
when you're applying it to a person, applying it to actions makes total sense. I would say that brings us to another point in our research that we found that when people started to have cracks in the ideology that they had taken on and started moving away from being fused with the group, some people argue that once you're fused with a group, it's very hard to unfuse. I don't find that to be the case, but I'm also a psychologist that believes people can change in part just from talking to them. What we found with the white supremacists, which is really interesting, is that they were told to stay away from minorities. Some of the guys would sneakily have sexual relationships with people of color or other ethnicities, but wouldn't admit it to anybody in the group. Mm. So they're supposed to stay away from minorities, hate Jews and hate them all. But when they got away from their group, like let's say the truck driver that drives across country and has to unload his truck, and every week he's unloading with a black guy, and the black guy says he wants a cigarette and starts chatting with him. It's like, wow, we have a lot in common. I know one of my friends that was in a cult, Steve Hassan, told me that.
We know Steve.
I figured that that when he was out promoting for the Moonies, he was parched. And some guy said, let me give you something to eat and drink. And he said it didn't get him out of the group, but it really shook him up. Because if everybody that's not a Moonie is evil, according to the group, then why is this guy being nice to him?
Right.
So I would say there is a power of one, and it's not our responsibility as victims of any group to be nice to them, but we should understand the power we have, because many people in our sample told us that they really got cracks in their fusion with the group from having positive interactions with minority members.
Right. That's so interesting. Mm. We had a former white supremacist on here as well. One of the big cracks for him was that he started working for a Jewish man who was very kind and generous and just did not meet the caricature in his head of what a Jewish man was supposed to be. It does seem like that is what happens so much of the time. And it's almost with regard to white supremacist ideology specifically, like asking people to not interact with minorities or people of color is in itself kind of information control, preventing them from interacting with people and getting more information about what those humans are actually like. I've just never thought of it that way before.
And that they're actually human.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's the same concept as like, don't read books that are not our specific scripture, you know, except mm-hmm. it's just with human interaction.
We find that with all these groups that they narrow your focus. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons that with our ISIS interviews and our Al-Shabaab interviews and our white supremacist interviews, for those that we could capture on video, we worked really hard to get the people to trust us enough, talking about trust me. To say, would you be willing to take part in a counter-narrative? So at the end of a two-hour interview, if we had their permission, we could go through and say, okay, this part represents how they got sucked into the group. This is what they thought they'd get out of it. This is what they actually got out of it. And here's their advice to others about joining. Mm. We find those to be really, really powerful. We think they're important because groups like ISIS told people, Mainline news is Islamophobic. They're lying about us. Those things aren't true that they're saying on the news. Just get your news from us. And then they were very prolific and good at providing their news. They had all these media outlets, and they still do. White supremacists, same thing. So when we make our counter-narrative videos, they're called Breaking the ISIS Brand and Escape Hate. We name them disgusting names. One of our Escape Hate ones is Black people are not your friend. And mm-hmm. it will show a Nazi symbol on it from the guy that's telling the story, because we illustrate with B-roll as the person's talking because it's a video. And we'll take that especially disgusting picture to be the thumbnail and the disgusting title, so that someone who is engaging in hate groups and looking for them will click on it. And then he'll get a big surprise, because we know that they've been told, only watch ours.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a trick.
Oh, that's so smart.
I think so. Most of the people we interview, when we explain the counter narrative project to them and ask them if they'll take part in it, they say exactly like you, oh, that is really smart.
How long into the video do they realize that something's awry?
Oh, this is interesting, because we partner with Facebook, and we learned that our first videos, and we still make them all 5-minute videos, but we learned that those don't play as well on Facebook because people would watch a minute of them. Mm. And then they, you know, the next thing would come up and they would, you know, it's just social media. That's the way it works. So we made 1-minute versions of the 5-minute ones. And it's usually about 15 seconds when the person is saying why they joined and this and that. And we don't put our logo or anything at that point. We just have the person talking. So you have no idea what you're listening to. And hopefully they engage you. So Facebook will give you these braggy metrics of, you reach 2 million people with a 15-second view. And I'm like, that's not helpful at all. Mm-hmm. You know, we want them to watch as much as possible of it. And we also want them to go to our website that corresponds with each of these videos. So right now, I think we have 50 videos for Escape Hate. And we have a website that we're building slowly but surely, called escapehate.org. And when we campaign on Facebook, we say, if you want to see more, and it also says it at the end of the video, go to escapehate.org. So if you were somebody that thought, I want to get out, but I have no idea how to, and you went to Escape Hate, it's got a whole page on all the organizations that might be able to help you, even some of them overseas. And the Breaking the ISIS Brand goes to therealjihad.org. Therealjihad.org is better populated. We've written a lot of blogs with our Sheikh Ali about Islam and the claims that ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab make that are simply false and not supported by good scriptural analysis.
So you've talked about how as a person begins to find their identity in the group, they start to fuse with the group and only consume materials from that group. So typically in cults, there's a leader who's directing this kind of information isolation. But what we're seeing, obviously, now in the modern era is that people are kind of self-isolating online and no one is really telling them to.
Well, Google and Facebook and Twitter is, because they all have algorithms that suggest to you, I mean, we did Breaking the ISIS Brand on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And on Instagram, you have to have followers for you to look legit and put things up. So our researcher, Molly Ellenberg, started following pages that looked extremist. They're supposed to be taken down, but she just followed them. And she said Instagram itself suggested everybody else.
Right.
So she just followed everybody that they suggested to her. And they got it right.
Right. I get so frustrated when people are like, you have the whole internet available to you to look at other information. But it's like, you kind of don't. Like, once you start going down a path of a particular kind of media, you just get fed that same media until you can become radicalized that way.
And the smart thing is, what I finally got my way, and we're really, really happy because State of Qatar got behind us on this. But I was saying for years, Al-Qaeda videos are so emotionally evocative, and they sing the nasheeds, which are the Islamic scriptures, and you know, just puts you into a trancey state. And I know I watched them at my friend's house. He's a Lebanese Belgian, and I was like, I'm going to join. I don't even understand Arabic, but they've convinced me. And he was like, you got to be kidding. I always said cognitive arguments are great. There's nothing wrong with them. But we need to be catching people the same way the terrorist groups do, which is right. with very emotionally evocative material.
Right.
And the more emotional it is, and the more you resonate with it, maybe with the victims that are being portrayed, you start to suspend your critical reasoning. Mm-hmm. And then I can get in. Yeah. And I know this as a therapist. I mean, if I'm sitting and working with you, and you know, and if you happen to be a dissociative, I just throw something out that's really emotionally evocative, and you know, I might flip you into a dissociative state, or I speak softly and then you're suddenly really listening to me. You know, there's all kinds of tricks you can do. Mm-hmm. And they're masters at it.
Speaking of masters, how often is there a charismatic leader? I remember I saw you had written something about a man named Anwar al-Awlaki. He inspired a lot of Westerners to join ISIS because of the way that he spoke. He was accessible and charismatic and I think spoke English. Is that a typical entry point? Like, is there typically a particular person who speaks very well in videos?
There's definitely different routes of incitement. And I would say one of the routes is to show you something really emotionally evocative and victimhood. But another is to be an ideologue that's an inciter. And then you sell an ideology to the people that are listening to you. And that's what al-Awlaki did. So he sold the ideology or promoted the ideology of endless jihad, that everyone has individual duty to jihad. Mm. So you can be living in Belgium and something breaks out in Syria, you have a duty to go join jihad, which is not substantiated in Islamic scriptures. You have a duty to make hijrah, which is also not substantiated. So that means that you have to move out of wherever you live, unless it's ruled by Sharia, and go and live with the true Muslims. And ISIS took it even a step further and said that they were the only true Muslims. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you couldn't go to Saudi, you couldn't go to Malaysia, couldn't go to Maldives. So there's insiders always in groups, and insiders often can't be arrested because they're smart enough not to say anything too far out. Mm-hmm. So Jeff Shoup was like that. He was the head of the MSM. He even said the FBI would routinely come in, visit him and ask him questions about people in the group. And he was warned. Tim Garrett also was a group leader, and he said he was warned. And they were told, if somebody in your group commits a crime and you haven't told us about it, will hold you responsible too. So some of these people, you know, were pointing out possible violent actors, but at the same time, all their ideology, all their rhetoric was encouraging people to be violent. Well, their official policy was don't be violent.
I just want to speak more to your point of like emotionality. I think that one area that so many of us get stuck on, if we see someone that we love maybe falling prey to conspiracy theories or any kind of, you know, extreme belief of any kind. A lot of people maybe have ultra conservative family members who they're worried are dipping into dangerous territory. Facts don't work, right? Facts are not the thing that get people out of their ideology. So what you're doing is an amazing way to reach people online. What are some of the other ways that you can kind of, as just a regular person, begin to try at least to de-radicalize someone in your life? And also, what has the official process been for you?
Well, when we've worked in prisons, and the first de-radicalization program that I put together was in Iraq, and it was ultimately applied to about 22,000 detainees that the U.S. government was holding. When you're dealing with people in prison, you can offer them incentives. You can say you'll get a quicker release if you take part in this process. You have to convince them that you're trustworthy, that you have authority, that you want to and you can help them. But I've always found that it's not hard to create rapport with these people because they're just normal human beings that want to be cared for. So if you come across as compassionate, they generally are interested in your compassion. Mm. Although, of course, you have to protect yourself because someone that has an evil intent will manipulate you.
Right.
And, you know, you might become their victim. That's why a lot of these people that are formers that do any kind of de-radicalization, disengagement work are always saying, I'm not sure if this person that I got a text message from is a plant, if they're trying to lure me into something, you know, even to saying things that maybe wouldn't be cool. I would say it has to start with a relationship. And then it depends what your expertise is. There's excellent people that have talked Al-Qaeda and ISIS out of it by catering to their vulnerabilities and their needs, you know, helping them to see, will you join this group because you didn't have your father? And, you know, let's talk about how we could build that up in you. You know, so there are psychologists, social worker types. And then there's plenty that have come in and said, brother, you've got Islam all wrong. You know, you're going to burn in hell if you keep following this. Let me tell you what the real Islam says, and let me show you the scriptures, and let me show you how to judge for yourself what's authentic and what's not authentic. And I think you'll very quickly see that Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Al-Shabaab are not following authentic hadiths. Both of those, they come from very different points of view, often work. For me, the best would be you do both. Same thing with white supremacists. If they have any ideology, you need to understand that ideology. You need to take it apart. You need to be able to say, okay, I get where you're going. But I would say if you don't have people coming to you and if you're not offering them something in prison, then I wouldn't come at somebody with facts, I would come at them with care and compassion. And for instance, I had a relative that called me. We have a huge family. And she said, I'm worried about my sister. She's her husband, her son, and she have all gone into QAnon. And we share the caretaking of our mother. And I don't know what to do about it. And I said, don't argue with her. Don't, you know, get into facts with her. You're both really dedicated Christians. One's a liberal, one's QAnon. Ask her how this fits with Christianity. And say, you know, if this is really a Christian movement, I need to be in it. And get her to convince you. And if she's convinced you, and then you have the opportunity to ask her questions without making her defensive. But right. She's feeling like, from what you're saying, that she's protecting you and sharing the inside knowledge with you.
That's such an interesting approach because, yeah, typically we want to ask questions from sort of an attacking perspective with this hostility. And that hostile approach makes people automatically defensive. But if the premise is that they are potentially converting you to their cause, and that's how you can kind of get them to see inconsistencies, that's super, super interesting. And Steve talks a lot about maintaining the relationship and how, while it's tempting to cut people off, they need to know that there's some kind of like support system if they do decide to leave that ideology or that group. So staying connected to them in a compassionate way is actually one of the most important things. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, you have to protect vulnerable people around you. So if this is, you know, Uncle Teddy, and he's coming to stay at your house and is going to talk your pre-adolescents into joining, you might need to make some really strong boundaries. You know, Uncle Teddy needs to know he has a safe place to come back to.
Right. So on a societal level, what are ways that we can prevent extremism? As you said, there are like dozens of factors, but what are some of the things that we could do on a sort of a grander scale?
Well, I don't think our social media companies will agree, but the algorithms could be changed. Mm-hmm. And the algorithms work so well for everything else. You know, it's kind of a pity, but maybe they can figure that out. I like it when I, you know, click on some shoes or click on dresses and I get 20 others suggested to me. That's the same algorithm. You know, if they're going to track you on shopping, you might as well get things you like suggested to you instead of things you were never interested in. Any part of our society will reap huge benefits if we start being much more aware of child abuse, particularly child sexual abuse. Mm. This creates such vulnerabilities in our society and people going down the wrong roads into drugs and alcohol, into cults, into extremist groups, because they've got a hole in their soul. Something's really hurting. They're angry. And the group plays upon that and tells them that they should stand up for all the other victims of the world. I think this is one of the reasons that QAnon probably latched into a lot of people that were sexually abused and have never told anybody about it.
Mm.
You know, it could be why, you know, the one guy picked up his gun and traveled across states to ostensibly stop Pizzagate. I mean, he didn't have a real reason to do that other than he had been led to believe there were victims in the basement.
Right.
And if he himself was a victim, you can see how powerful that would have been.
Right.
So the more that we can stop kids from being victimized, early reporting and taking early reporting extremely seriously, stopping bullying in schools, getting good trauma treatment for the people that have been hurt. The mental health system in the U.S. is so poor right now.
Yeah.
I mean, people that don't have money. I mean, finally, we got it that the insurance companies, for those of us that have good insurance, I don't think they can put a limit too much on getting weekly appointments with a psychotherapist. They used to be able to.
Mm.
But I think now it's been considered equal to medical care.
Oh, good.
But really, everybody should be able to get psychological services that needs it.
Yeah. I'm someone who has a degree of privilege at this moment in my life. And even for me, finding good therapists that I could afford was really difficult in my time of need. So I can't imagine being somebody who is low income right now and suffering from some kind of traumatic event or really any mental health crisis.
Well, the model for low income is hand them pills.
Right.
And often something they also can't afford. And even in prisons, they're just handed pills and sometimes, you know, yanked off a prescription with no warning. Mm. And we know that some people get suicidal when they're taken off of Zoloft or Prozac really quickly.
Right.
And that has to change. And we have to change our whole understanding of trauma. It's not something that you just want to medicate away. You want to get to the heart of it. You want to create real resilience in the person. And I'm not saying that psychotropics aren't useful. They are. If you need to keep functioning, they keep you functioning,
mm-hmm.
but they never get to the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
And if you get to the heart of the matter, you really change people's neurobiology.
Right. I think that's so important. I didn't find that medication was helpful for me so much as just actual, you know, CBT and EMDR and all of the things. But you also studied resilience.
We've looked a lot at resilience. And I would just go back to that, too, and say, now there's all these new things coming out with computers tracking your brain. Because with trauma, we know Bessel van der Kolk was putting people into MRIs and inducing a traumatic flashback and finding out that with a lot of them, Broca's area, which is your ability to verbalize, would go black, meaning no blood was flowing to that part of the brain anymore. And it goes with speechless terror.
Hmm.
And now we're finding that with all kinds of traumas, you can get learning disabilities, you can get inabilities of your brain to function well together. And, you know, they can put headsets on you that do these, I don't know if it's EEG, I don't know what it is, that can both stimulate different parts of your brain or watch you and reward you.
Neurofeedback, is that what you're referring to?
Yes. And there's all kinds of devices coming out now. You know, it's really exciting to see that we're moving away just from this chemical model, which has its uses. But, you know, we really want to see true healing in people.
Right. I also really...
I'm glad you're speaking about your treatment and that you're brave enough to speak about it. Good for you.
Thank you.
You're helping a lot of people.
Oh, God, I hope so. It's embarrassing sometimes. But
no, it's not embarrassing. It's brave and it's wonderful that you're doing it.
Thank you.
And it's a role model to other people. It's not embarrassing at all.
I appreciate that a lot. Thank you. I was also wondering about poverty. Is poverty one of the factors, or do you find that it's kind of across all income levels?
You know, that was an interesting thing when we first started studying Palestinians. We found that college educated were much more likely to be terrorists than impoverished people.
Interesting.
So, you know, if you're impoverished, you're oftentimes struggling just to live. But on the other side, if you're a young man and your family's impoverished, you can fall into anything. So I'd say poverty plays a role, but it's just like trauma. It's not ever the one end all be all. It's just one variable among 50.
It seems to me, you know, a lot of the people who join cults join when they are younger, when they're like around college age. And I wonder if part of that is due to just like trying to figure out who you are and where you fit in the world and like find your identity and find your purpose.
So it's a developmental stage at that age.
Right.
From, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 onward, your developmental requirement is to separate from your family to a certain extent and to establish your own identity. And depending on what kind of culture you came from, you might still stay really tied into that family, or you may go completely independent. I think Americans tend to go for the full independence. So we go to college living far away from our families and that kind of thing. And as you're searching to build your own identity, that's an extremely vulnerable point when a cult or a terrorist group or a white supremacist group can grab a hold of you and start to build it for you.
Mm. What are ways to protect ourselves from being targeted by any kind of group?
I would just say question everything you're told. Develop a healthy skepticism. Judge actions more than words. I mean, all of us, when we hear beautiful words, especially about ourselves, we want to believe them.
Right.
And when we're offered membership, we want to belong.
Right.
That's human.
Yeah.
But, you know, always be asking yourself, what is the price of belonging? And do those beautiful words match with the actions? I know I had the opportunity. My husband was ambassador in Greece, and we hung out with some extremely wealthy people. And everyone would always be very kind and polite to me and my husband because he was the U.S. ambassador. So to gauge a person's character, I often watched how they interacted with their servants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody that's really rude to service staff probably doesn't have that good of a heart.
Right.
You know, just always be judging actions, looking for little clues, and, you know, just having a healthy skepticism when you first start a relationship. And the other thing that I think is always useful for everybody to know is that when we first start relationships with anybody, we have all kinds of projections. Because that person shows us their best self, and we have a hope for them to be probably better than they truly are.
Right.
And, you know, if you meet someone kind and good, you might project even more kindness and goodness on them. And when they disappoint you, you're like, oh, well, at least they're ordinarily kind and good. But if they're trying to trick you and you go with all your projections for a long time, you got in too deep. And then there's going to be costs of breaking off that relationship.
Right. I think of, do you know Yuval Lauer?
I think I've heard the name, but I don't remember.
He's a researcher. He was on one of our episodes. Really interesting work. He talks about the cultic relationship having the similar phases to any kind of attachment, where in the beginning you're in sort of an infatuation period. Oh. So you are blinded to the faults or the flaws of the belief system or the group. And similarly, like over time, that will fade unless they kind of keep generating emotional experiences for you. But I always found that really interesting that, yeah, we can be blinded to the downsides of something that feels really good in the beginning, the same way we can with a new boyfriend who's lavishing attention on us.
And that's just good advice for life, of be aware of your projections.
Right.
And be aware, is the person truly living up to what you've projected on them?
Right.
Because, you know, everybody, when you first meet them, they're, you know, going to put their best foot forward. They may try to meet your needs in order to get something out of you. And just keep observing and don't get fooled by your own projections.
Yeah. As we're wrapping up, do you have any thoughts on the situation between Russia and Ukraine and how that pertains to extremism?
Well, I think we can say that we're seeing a lot of travelers now, thousands of them going to the Ukraine, and the Ukraine is calling for foreign fighters. But among them, we know that white supremacists are answering the call.
Mm.
And Ukraine doesn't necessarily want them, but it has been something that's been going on since 2014 with white supremacists going to train in Ukraine with the Azov Brigade. So once again, we're watching people make decisions based on internet interactions to go join. And we also know that Putin's talking about 16,000 Syrians, I think he's going to pay them, coming to fight for him. I hope that doesn't become a truth. So in his case, he probably won't use disinformation. You know, everyone that's making really serious decisions about their life to possibly be a hero, and it might be very heroic to go and fight in Ukraine, But, you know, you should also evaluate what you're, where you're getting your information from that you're making really big decisions about. Right. And then we need to keep aware of these people coming back, particularly back into the EU, that have been supplied with weapons, that may now know how to use explosives, that have a white supremacist ideology. They're not the most of the people traveling. I know Germany has 1,000 that have gone over to Ukraine, and they've identified among them 3. That's probably a way low underestimate. But when they come back, we need to keep an eye on them.
Right. Well, where can people find your organization and find your work online?
All of our papers, pretty much, are on the website, ICSVE, that's for International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism.org. Maybe you can put it up with the podcast, ICSVE.org. If you want to watch our counter-narrative videos, you go over to our ICSVE YouTube channel. You can also look under my name on academia, and you'll come up with all my papers. That should keep you busy for a while.
Yeah, you're so incredible. I admire you so much. I'm like, fascinating work that you're doing, and really, really important. So thank you for all of it. And thank you for coming on today.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, y'all. She is fucking incredible. Megan, I don't think that asking if you would become a terrorist is quite the right question. So
no.
So I guess I'm wondering, would you feel comfortable kind of doing what she does and going into these dangerous groups and territories and talking to these extremists?
Absolutely. That would be so intriguing. I love the book Silence of the Lambs. I love the movie Silence of the Lambs. I love Clarice going down there and like, yeah, I love that shit. So absolutely.
Me too. I mean, I think it's, you know, this is just like the question of my life. It's like the most the interesting thing like on earth to me, which is how do people fall prey to extreme belief and then how do they come back from it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's literally like what part of the entire thesis of this podcast, but I guess terrorism is just the more extreme version than, you know, former cult members. I would be very interested in that job.
My mom has a radio where she listens to police the scanner stuff and will,
she does.
Like she thinks she's a spy solving things. I guess that's what happens when you don't have a television, but also my mom has a little bit of that too.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to be an FBI profiler when I was a teenager, you know, so that would be, that's just like an extension of that childhood dream.
I think I see it coming to fruition for you somehow, some way. So
thank you so much. So I'm going to do one more shout out for my crowdfunding campaign for my film.
Yeah.
Guys, part of what the film deals with is literally like, what is the experience like of knowing that you've gone too far down a particular ideological pathway and influenced people in a very destructive way? As a result, what happens in your brain and how do you deal with that cognitive dissonance? So it's like, it's very much connected with the general spirit of this podcast. And I'll give you that link one more time. It's bit.ly/pruningfilm. Okay, that's enough. Shut up, Lola. Stop it. Okay.
Lola, we love it. As for now, we can't wait to see you here next week. Have a great week. And remember to follow your gut. Watch out for red flags. And never,
ever trust me.
Bye.